St. Cloud State University is organizing its last year of Global Ghost Conference. This two-day-long conference started today with a session on priorities for funding immigrants-focused projects in Minnesota. It'll continue with another lecture on what if we looked at immigrants differently. Monday's lectures will complete with a musical concert at the Atwood Little Theater from 7 to 9. Tuesday, there'll be four panels including issues of social practice and policy in Minnesota immigrant communities, the role of immigrant workers in Minnesota's labor movement, We Are Minnesota, Recent Immigrant Oral History Project, and Day Laborers and Challenges and Issues Specific to Latinos, Asians, and African Americans and Refugees. There'll be also a lecture about the new economy organizing immigrant guest workers. We are speaking with Professor of Sociology Stephen Filian, who has been the organizer of the Global Ghost Conference for the past 7 years. So, could you please tell me, as the organizer of this Global Ghost Local Conference, what issues have you discussed during the past years, and what's going to be new this year?
The issues we've discussed in the past years have been focused on the conditions of workers, immigrants as workers. And that's going to be something that we're going to continue to be focusing on at the conference this year. In the past, we've had more direct participation of groups that are involved in organizing immigrant workers in Minnesota, or immigrant workers themselves coming on panels and talking about the organizing work that they're doing in different contexts. This year, we're having a focus on the worker-centered, but also focus on other elements of, more broadly speaking, immigration issues in Minnesota. One of the new things that we're doing this year is, or not necessarily new, but one of the more stronger focus of the conference is going to be work that students are doing in the field, in doing research on conditions of immigrants in St. Cloud and in Minnesota. So we have, I think, four panels altogether that are looking at different classes. For example, we have Mary Wingard's public history class, which did a series, whose students did a number of, were all required to do oral history interviews with recently arrived immigrants in St. Cloud. So they're going to be reporting on their findings from that class. We have students from a social work graduate class taught by Conseiller Thibault, which looks at social issues affecting Minnesota's immigrant communities. And so one of the students from that class is going to be reporting similarly on her field work with immigrants in St. Cloud, dealing with different issues in terms of economics, cultural issues, and mental health issues, and the like. And then from my, I also teach a class this semester focused on organizing, but with a focus on organizing of immigrant workers. And I'm going to have students who are going to be reporting on their involvement in organizations in St. Cloud that are organizing immigrant workers and their efforts to organize students to go and to become involved in or active in activities or actions put on by organizations in St. Cloud. So that's one kind of a new thing. We have a panel that I've been wanting to put on for many years, but just not been able to really coordinate. But this year has kind of come together very nicely. I've always wanted to do a panel on foundations in Minnesota and how they fund immigrant-related projects and what priorities that guide their funding, and also what the outcomes are and what challenges they face. And so we're going to be having three representatives from some of the most prestigious foundations in Minnesota, namely the Initiative Foundation, the Morgan Family Foundation, and the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, all of which fund millions of dollars to different projects that are focused on immigrant workers and immigrants and helping immigrants with issues that they face. So that's going to be another exciting component to it. There is one thing that is new. And that's one of the keynote speakers who we've been trying to get to come here for years, and that's Bruce Corey. He's an economist from Concordia University. He's probably one of the most prolific, if not the most prolific, go-to person when it comes to any time that myths about immigrants or refugees, immigrant refugees, come up in the media or just out there in the general discourse. He's the person that the media turns to and says, "So what's the actual story?" Because he's done tons of research on and data collection on the actual contribution of immigrants and refugees to Minnesota society. And so he's going to be talking about that topic on Monday, April 1st at noon, right after the panel on the foundations. So that's another new thing. And we have one other new component, which is a musical concert, which we've never had. We've always had an artistic component to our panels, but this musical concert is one more new component that we haven't had. And it's called Crossing Borders, a musical story about immigrants told in words, music, and images. It's being put on by a band called the Pachanga Society, which is quite well known in both Stearns, in St. Cloud, and in Minnesota. And they have a guest named Dan Daddy Squeeze Hute Newton, who's often featured on the Prairie Home Companion by Garrison Keillor. So he's on that program as well. So he's a very well-known musician. It's kind of a big deal that we're able to attract them to come and do a performance here. And it's kind of a Woody Guthrie kind of a music combined with theater style performance that'll go on Monday, April 11th from 7 o'clock to 9 in the Little Atwood Theater. So we're really excited about that. And then on the second day of the conference, on April 12th, on Tuesday, April 12th, that day we're more focused on immigrant workers and the issues that they face in the workplace. And we're really interested in, one, what students have found. So that panel just mentioned about the students in my class, they're going to be starting off the day talking about their involvement with the Greater Minnesota Workers Center and the work that they're doing around organizing workers in the meatpacking companies, especially in poultry companies, and actions that they're going to be involved in. There's also going to be a panel discussion on the role of immigrant workers in the labor movement, and that's going to be facilitated by the keynote speaker who's coming at 12:30 on Tuesday. His name is Sackett Soni, and he himself is an immigrant who came to the United States to study and ended up having to work part-time and discovered the way in which he is an immigrant. Faced considerable exploitation due to his status as an immigrant and as a so-called guest worker in the United States. And he ended up organizing guest workers in the aftermath of Katrina down in New Orleans, when there were thousands of guest workers brought up from Latin America and Mexico to work on the reconstruction of New Orleans in post-Katrina. He put together an organization called the National Guest Workers Alliance, that focuses on organizing guest workers from abroad. And in a nutshell, the organization is designed to address and to enable workers to be able to address those forms of exploitation and make demands on employers to treat them like workers who have citizenship. That every worker has a right to being treated with dignity, whether they're so-called guest workers or they're undocumented workers or they're workers who've been here, whose families have been here for decades. So that's going to be kind of exciting that we have him here as a guest. He's very busy and very prominent in the worker center field, but he's also going to be available to facilitate a discussion among two worker centers in St. Cloud and in the Twin Cities on the role of workers in Minnesota, in the labor movement.
What changes will you or do anticipate regarding the next presidential candidate? Do you think there is anybody out there who might be able to continue working with immigrants, who might be able to facilitate their problems, the problems that they are facing, or what are the expectations from the following president?
Well, I mean, I guess that depends on who you support for the presidency. I won't go into my own personal perspective on that. I'll merely say that, you know, I have the same concern that a lot of people have, that a lot of the rhetoric that has been coming up, especially in the Republican debates around immigrants, has been one that has been unconstructive and harmful to not just immigrants, but
different nationalities,
and the native-born population. So my hope is that what we get out, what we're looking for in this presidential campaign, or from our presidential candidates, are people who actually understand the actual conditions that immigrants face in the United States, and especially as workers. And instead of looking at them as enemies and as scapegoats, that instead we talk about, well, in what way can we do the same thing? In what way can we be helpful to them in organizing them, especially in the workplace? Because that is how every immigrant group historically in the United States has moved forward, is through organizing in the workplace. They haven't just moved forward because the society learned to value their cultural differences or their racial differences and the like. And those have always been very important, but they've also moved forward because they've attained power through organizing in the workplace and winning better wages, better work conditions, and the ability to, move forward or move their children forward. That's what I think we ought to really be looking at is, are candidates really serious about taking that part of the immigrant experience in the United States seriously? Because that's been the history of the United States. That's been the history of the immigrant experience in the United States, which every immigrant group we're talking about is they've always had to organize in the workplace and beyond. And so if we're facilitating that, we're moving it forward. If the presidential campaign facilitates that process, it's something that moves us forward. If it's something that doesn't facilitate that process, we're not going to move forward.
And
the we is not just immigrants. We is immigrants and people here and citizens.
It seems this is the last time that you're going to be organizer of this Global Goals Local Conference. Could you please tell me why and what are you going to do after this? Who is going to be in charge of organizing this in the coming years?
I've been elected to chair the sociology program, co-chair of the sociology and anthropology department for the coming 3 years. So therefore, I'm not going to be continuing my role as director of the research group. I want to keep myself from being too busy and too occupied and not having time for the important things in life, like my son. The directorship of the research group is planned on, it's not official, but the plan is to transition to Monica Garcia Perez, who is an economist, who has been very active in the research group and will be taking over the position of director effective fall 2016. And I've told Monica and the research group that how they want to proceed with the research group and what activities the research group does is entirely up to them. And so I can't even tell you right now actually whether or not there'll be a conference next year or not, because the research group might change its priorities to doing colloquia series or local speakers or a combination of small research projects. I don't really know, because like I said, I want to step away from that position and let the new director decide now what do they want to do with the organization. I've always prioritized doing the conference, but I don't think the conference is the only way in which a research group has to operate.
Well, is there anything else that you want to refer to?
No, it's been great doing this conference for 7 years, and it's some of the best. It's been exhausting putting together conferences. Some of my colleagues think I'm out of my mind putting this much time into a conference and doing everything else that I do. But I think that the community and the students and faculty here have benefited greatly from the Global Goals Local and having a research group on immigrant workers in Minnesota. I'm pleased that there's a commitment to continuing the research group in the future. And I think that I'm excited about Monica Garcia Perez taking it over, and I think she's going to do a great job.
I'm sure there are people out there who appreciate your efforts of putting this conference together for these past 6 to 7 years, and the next director will take good care of that too. Well, thank you for your time and spending your time with us at KVSE.org.
Okay, thank you, Mohammed.
We were speaking with Professor of Sociology Stephen Frillian, who has been the organizer of the Global Goals Conference for the past 7 years. St. Cloud State University is organizing its last year of Global GOES Conference. This two-day-long conference started today with a session on priorities for funding immigrants-focused projects in Minnesota. It will continue with another lecture on what if we looked at immigrants differently. Monday's lectures will complete with a musical concert at the Atwood Little Theater from 7 to 9. Tuesday, there will be four panels including issues of social practice and policy in Minnesota immigrant communities, the role of immigrant workers in Minnesota's labor movement, We Are Minnesota, Recent Immigrant Oral History Project, and Day Laborers and Challenges and Issues Specific to Latinos, Asians, and African Americans and Refugees. There will be also a lecture about the new economy organizing immigrant guest workers. Please stay tuned to your sound alternative KVSC 88.1 FM for your future features.
Rachel Coyne is a novelist and poet. She lives in Lindstrom, Minnesota. Her book, The Patron Saint of Lost Comfort Lake, is nominated for the upcoming Minnesota Book Awards. It's published by New Rivers Press, and Rachel Coyne joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've gotten some great reviews of this book and a nomination. Author Lynn Enger says that Rachel Coyne writes like an angel with scorched wings. How does that feel to hear that?
Yeah, it feels pretty good. I don't know if, sort of the process of getting those blurbs for the books, but Lynn was actually my high school teacher. He was one of my very first writing teachers, so I was particularly honored that he wanted to say something on the back of my book. I went to kind of a special school for the arts, the Purbidge Center for Arts Education, which is kind of a public boarding school for the arts, and way back then, Lynn was one of my first teachers, the first person that was ever kind of like, yay, you're a writer.
Oh, wow. How did going to the Purbidge School for the Arts, how did that change you, do you think, if you had gone to a traditional high school?
Oh, I think it saved me.
Oh.
I've never said anything less. I was doing fine in high school, and I would have gone on to college and done all those things that I did anyways, but Purbidge has just always felt like my spiritual home. It's where I met all these wonderful people and people who've just had such faith in me through my whole life that I can't kind of imagine the path my life would have taken without it.
Oh, that's great. It's still operating and...
In fact, I go back almost every year, and I help out and do the intake interviews for the new class of writers that are coming to the school. So That's one of the things that I look forward to every single year is meeting those new kids. So
it's great. We live in a great state for the arts, and especially for writing.
We do.
And that school is not usually talked about in that realm of hitting kids at that age. We have grant money, we have the Legacy Fund, but it's pretty cool to see how everything's connected and where we live.
We do. My son goes to one of those immersion schools for languages, and there was a lottery to get in. And when he got in, I remember just feeling so grateful to live in Minnesota because, our kids are just, I'm not alike. They're not alike. And this idea that there was a school out there for me when that was what I needed to learn best, to develop best, to kind of fit in and sort of start to see a future for myself is just such a relief to me that school was there.
And that leads you to here you are with a nomination for your book that came out last year, The Patron Saint of Lost Comfort Lake. There's such a stark photograph on the front of this book with black and white and a girl on a dock with waves, and she's holding the deer skull that really shows up in a lot of ways within the book. It seems like this place and these characters, of course, but it's a pretty stark story as well. So where does it take place?
Well, it takes place in Comfort Lake, which is the second novel that I've set there. And Comfort Lake is it's sort of like my home, but not kind of. It's that Lindstrom area of Minnesota, very much settled kind of in the lake area with the pines. And Comfort Lake is actually a real lake. It's less romantically called Lake Comfort. I kind of inverted it for the novel, and I think it's named after an old farmer Comfort. So there's a particular freedom for me in being able to rely on the places I've known since I was a very small child to kind of give me the backdrop for some of the tragic events that I think about. And the main character is suffering through a lifelong disease of addiction. And I don't know, there's just, when I go to write these, I mean, I could set them in New York, I could set them in California, California. I've been to those places. But I think particularly when I'm writing about these kinds of themes, I reach for that kind of comfort of my home territory and the things that always, when I was a child growing up, just meant so much to me.
Well, you know, we meet Jane right off the bat, your main character, when yep. she's right in the midst of some of the worst times in her addiction, and it has to do with a lot with her family. I think with your book, we don't want to give a lot away, but kind of explain where we start and what's going on with her.
Well, you're right. She's sort of at, I think she's at kind of a low point. I mean, it is without a doubt a book about somebody hitting the bottom of kind of their addiction and trying to figure out what's going on with themselves. She's, I always like with my books, I just kind of, by the time I finish writing them, I always think I can kind of sum them up in one sentence. And with my first novel, it was kind of, you know, you really, about alcoholism, you know, you really have to decide you're going to live. And nothing in this world is going to help you until that day when you decide you're going to live and start walking forward. And then this book was the second book I wrote about alcoholism, and kind of the one sentence about that is, just kind of take the help that's offered to you. There's a, God damn it, actually, take the help that's offered to you, God damn it. You know, there's this, she's really, really hitting bottom, and you can just, it's almost painful how all of these people in her life, the local police officer, this figure that comes from her childhood, Ardell Ring, even her own mother, as messed up as her own mother is, all these people, you can just feel their hands straining towards her in the dark to kind of help her out, and she's just so lost in her own despair that she really can't find her own way out. And that's when there's almost, that's when this character is introduced. There's a young girl right at the very beginning of the novel. There's a young girl who's found drowned in her mother's backyard. And the discovery of that body is so shocking to her that it almost takes kind of this supernatural presence in the character's mind where, she gives it too much importance in her thoughts. And as a result, you feel even this sort of deceased girl, this very young girl, even trying to help her. And that's what she's really struggling with, is to kind of go forward and take those steps.
We're talking with Rachel Coyne about her Minnesota Book Award nominated novel called The Patron Saint of Lost Comfort Lake. You know, I think there's something I was drawn to in the place of it because it reflects kind of her inner turmoil in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And it may not be as stark as that in real life, but, you know, I live in northern Minnesota. It's not unusual for me during deer hunting season, and I live in a town, I'm not completely in the middle of nowhere, to see deer carcasses hanging out in the front yards of people's houses.
Yep.
And I mean, it's a fact of life, and people hunt, and but that picture on the front has that deer skull, and then the little chapter heads all have that on there as well. Yep. How does that imagery play into what you wrote here?
Well, I think I'm a lot like you. I kind of grew up with the hunting and curing the deer. It's always just kind of been starkly in my imagination, and that's what I like to play with, is you see things all the time, but I kind of like to give them that kind of magical quality, or almost like a magical realism quality, where you're like, oh, I never thought about it that way. One of the things I will tell you is that my husband's father was just simply a lifelong poacher, just unregenerate. You know, my husband, all of his stories of his childhood involved that there were three or four deer hanging in the basement, hidden from the authorities. You know, those creepy old sand floor basements
yeah.
in northern Minnesota that we've all seen with the deer hanging there. And I guess his stories kind of just, along with my own childhood images, kind of just captivated me. And I saw the deer as just being kind of a symbol of a lot of different things. Like, in this book, Jane's father is the poacher, and I think that's kind of, he's not just a poacher of deer. There's just so much that he's taken from people. I think that's just such a good metaphor, and it kind of all wrapped together in one. And then there's another thing that kind of is in the back of my mind, is that when I was a child, growing up in Minnesota, you can't help that there's a lot of Ojibwe Anishinaabe stories that you hear. And one of the ones that I remember being captivated with as a child was this idea that there's such a thing called the deer woman, and that she's a beautiful woman who would lure people into the woods, and then she would transform into a deer and kind of run away, and then you'd be lost in the woods. And that story is just, it's not explicitly in the novel anywhere, but I would say that's one of those fairy tales that's always haunted me and I've never let go of. So there's the idea of that jumping in and out of the pages too, particularly around the images of the child that's died as a result of the drowning.
The way that you wrote of this basement with the poached deer and a bucket of blood and that dirt floor, I could smell it, I could feel it. You must have felt that as you wrote it as well.
Yes. In fact, I felt all of this book. I don't think there's a book that I've written that I have ever felt as deeply. In fact, when I finished writing this book, I turned to my husband and I said, I don't know if I want to do this again. And I actually did take a full solid 6 months of writing off, which I hadn't done since I was 15. I just, you know, I felt for Jane. As much as she's a problematic character, and I have people who come up to me all the time, oh, you know, I couldn't stand this addict. I couldn't stand her addictions. I couldn't stand the things that she did to her child. But then they always pause and say, but you know, I kind of was at the end. I was kind of rooting for her. I was kind of hoping for her. And I think I felt all those same things when I was writing it as well.
Well, I think everyone has been through something like this, or something has happened in their family. Hopefully for most of us, it's not maybe as dark, but there are so many things going on that people do not talk about. And while I understand, I mean, in some ways it was a hard book to read, but I also couldn't put it down. I feel like unless we share these kinds of stories, we're not going to really understand what people go through.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. You know, and I just had this experience just this morning where, not a friend, but a friend's friend. I saw, you know, you open up your Facebook in the morning, and so I saw an obituary. And one of the things that I've noticed being an artist, running in artistic circles for whatever reason, but there's just a lot of obituaries in my life, you know, not dear friends all the time, but friends of friends. And I opened up this obituary, and it was like one of the first times I can remember where, you know, the recitation of death talked about what a great person he was and fun and how he'd never missed the harvest. But then it just simply noted that he died after a long struggle with addiction. And that just struck me as almost like kind of like a coming out of the closet moment, or just a being honest moment that I think, I don't know, it just felt to me even maybe like in the early days of the AIDS epidemic when you never even acknowledged that somebody had died of HIV or AIDS. And maybe now, as a culture and a country, the addiction is just so tragic. And to just finally acknowledge that on an obituary just this morning kind of really struck me in the heart, you know?
Well, I hope it's not true. Did you only take a chunk of time off? Are you back to writing?
Yep, I'm back to writing.
Okay, good.
But, you know, I went back, and what I actually started working on was my son was 16 at the time, so I started writing a young adult novel for him.
Oh.
So it got a little bit more lighthearted. And I've worked on a couple young adult novels since then, you know, but it's been a while. So I think I might go back to writing some literary fiction pretty soon here. I think that'll be the next project. But
I'm glad to hear that. The Patron Saint of Lost Comfort Lake by Rachel Coyne, nominated for the Minnesota Book Award. We wish you the best at the Book Awards and hope we can talk again in the future.
Thank you very much, Heidi.
Real Good Words is supported in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.